Welcome to the Sagebrush Trail. I'm Wardell, and our first novel is the book that started the whole Western genre and everything we imagine about the West. So saddle up, partner, and let's head for Wyoming 1885. The Virginian by Owen Wister. Chapter 1. Enter the Man. Some notable sight was drawing the passengers, both men and women, to the window, and therefore I rose and crossed the car to see what it was. I saw near the track an enclosure, and round it some laughing men, and inside it some whirling dust, and amid the dust some horses, plunging, huddling, and dodging. They were cow ponies in a corral, and one of them would not be caught, no matter who threw the rope. We had plenty of time to watch this sport, for our train had stopped that the engine might take water at the tank before it pulled us up beside the station platform of Medicine Bow. We were also 6 hours late and starving for entertainment. The pony in the corral was wise and rapid of limb. Have you seen a skillful boxer watch his antagonist with a quiet, incessant eye? Such an eye as this did the pony keep upon whatever man took the rope. The man might pretend to look at the weather, which was fine, or he might affect earnest conversation with a bystander. It was bootless. The pony saw through it. No feint hoodwinked him. This animal was thoroughly a man of the world. His undistracted eye stayed fixed on the dissembling foe, and the gravity of his hoarse expression made the matter one of high comedy. Then the rope would sail out at him, but he was already elsewhere. And if horses laugh, gaiety must have abounded in that corral. Sometimes the pony took a turn alone. Next he had slid in a flash among his brothers, and the whole of them, like a school of playful fish, whipped round the corral, kicking up the fine dust, and, I take it, roaring with laughter. Through the window glass of our Pullman, the thud of their mischievous hoofs reached us, and the strong, humorous curses of the cowboys. Then for the first time I noticed a man who sat on the high gate of the corral looking on, for he now climbed down with the undulations of a tiger, smooth and easy, as if his muscles flowed beneath his skin. The others had all visibly whirled the rope, some of them even shoulder high. I did not see his arm lift or move. He appeared to hold the rope down low by his leg, but like a sudden snake I saw the noose go out its length and fall true, and the thing was done. As the captured pony walked in with a sweet church door expression, our train moved slowly on to the station, and a passenger remarked, "That man knows his business." But the passenger's dissertation upon roping I was obliged to lose, for Medicine Bow was my station. I bade my fellow travelers goodbye and descended, a stranger, into the great cattle land, and here in less than 10 minutes I learned news which made me feel a stranger indeed. My baggage was lost. It had not come on my train. It was adrift somewhere back in the 2,000 miles that lay behind me. And by way of comfort, the baggage man remarked that passengers often got astray from their trunks, but the trunks mostly found them after a while. Having offered me this encouragement, he turned whistling to his affairs and left me planted in the baggage room at Medicine Bow. I stood deserted among crates and boxes, blankly holding my check, hungry and forlorn. I stared out through the door at the sky and the plains, but I did not see the antelope shining among the sagebrush, nor the great sunset light of Wyoming. Annoyance blinded my eyes to all things save my grievance. I saw only a lost trunk, and I was muttering half aloud, "What forsaken hole is this?" when suddenly from outside on the platform came a slow voice. "Off to get married again? Oh, don't." The voice was southern and gentle and drawling, and a second voice came in immediate answer, cracked and querulous. "It ain't again. Who says it's again? Who told you anyway?" And the first voice responded caressingly, "Why, your son DeClose told me, Uncle Huey. They are speaking mighty loud of nuptials." "You don't worry me," snapped Uncle Huey with shrill heat. And the other gently continued, "Ain't them gloves same as you wore to your last wedding?" "You don't worry me! You don't worry me!" now screamed Uncle Huey. Already I had forgotten my trunk. Care had left me. I was aware of the sunset and had no desire but for more of this conversation, for it resembled none that I had heard in my life so far. I stepped to the door and looked out upon the station platform. Lounging there at ease against the wall was a slim young giant, more beautiful than pictures. His broad, soft hat was pushed back. A loose, knotted, dull scarlet handkerchief sagged from his throat, and one casual thumb was hooked in the cartridge belt that slanted across his hips. He had plainly come many miles from somewhere across the vast horizon, as the dust upon him showed. His boots were white with it. His overalls were gray with it. The weather-beaten bloom of his face shone through it duskily, as the ripe peaches look upon their trees in a dry season. But no dinginess of travel or shabbiness of attire could tarnish the splendor that radiated from his youth and strength. The old man, upon whose temper his remarks were doing such deadly work, was combed and curried to a finish, a bridegroom swept and garnished, but alas, for age. Had I been the bride, I should have taken the giant, dust and all. He had by no means done with the old man. "Why, you've hung wedding garments on every limb," he now drawled with admiration. "Who's the lucky lady this trip?" The old man seemed to vibrate. "Tell you there ain't been no other. Call me a Mormon, would you?" "Oh, why, that. Call me a Mormon? Then name some of my wives. Name two. Name one. Dare you."
"Oh, that Laramie widow promised you."
"Shucks."
"Only her doctor suddenly ordered southern climate and—"
"Shucks. You're a false alarm."
"So nothing but her lungs came between you. Next, you'd most got united with Cattle Kate only."
"Tell you, you're a false alarm."
"Only she got hung."
"Where's the wives in all this? Show the wives. Come now."
"That corn-fed biscuit shooter at Rawlins you gave the canary."
"Never married her. Never did marry."
"But you come so near, Uncle. She was the one left you that letter explaining how she'd gotten married to a young card player the very day before her ceremony with you was due, and—"
"Aye, you're nothing. You're a kid. You don't amount to—"
"And how she'd never, never forget to feed the canary."
"This country's getting full of kids," stated the old man witheringly. "It's doomed." This crushing assertion plainly satisfied him, and he blinked his eyes with renewed anticipation. His tall tormentor continued with a face of unchanging gravity and a voice of gentle solicitude.
"How is the health of that unfortunate?"
"That's right. Pour your insults. Pour 'em on a sick, afflicted woman."
The eyes blinked with combative relish. "Insults? Oh, no, Uncle Huey."
"That's all right. Insults goes."
"Why, I was mighty relieved when she began to recover her memory. Now, last time I heard, they told me she'd got it pretty near all back. Remembered her father and her mother and her sisters and brothers and her friends and her happy childhood and all her doings except only your face. The boys was betting she'd get that far, too, give her time, but I reckon after such a terrible sickness as she had, that would be expecting most too much." With this, Uncle Huey jerked out a small parcel.
"Shows how much you know," he cackled. "There, now see that? That's my ring she sent me back, being too unstrung for marriage, so she don't remember me, don't she? Ha ha! I always said you was a false alarm."
The southerner put more anxiety into his tone.
"And so you're a-taking the ring right on to the next one," he exclaimed. "Oh, don't go get married again, Uncle Huey. What's the use of being married?"
"What's the use?" echoed the bridegroom with scorn. "When you grow up, you'll think different."
"Well, of course I expect to think different when my age is different. I'm having the thoughts proper to 24.
And you're having the thoughts proper to 60.
50!
Shrieked Uncle Huey, jumping in the air. The Southerner took a tone of self-reproach.
"Now how could I forget you was 50? He murmured. "When you've been telling it to the boys so careful for the last 10 years.
Have you ever seen a cockatoo, the white kind with a topknot, enraged by insult? The bird erects every available feather upon its person. So did Uncle Huey seem to swell. Clothes, mustache, and woolly white beard, and without further speech, he took himself on board the eastbound train, which now arrived from its siding in time to deliver him. Yet this was not why he had not gone away before. At any time he could have escaped into the baggage room or withdrawn to a dignified distance until his train should come up. But the old man had evidently got a sort of joy from this teasing. He had reached that inevitable age when we are tickled to be linked with affairs of gallantry, no matter how. With him now, the eastbound departed slowly into that distance whence I had come. I stared after it as it went its way to the far shores of civilization. It grew small in the unending gulf of space, until all sign of its presence was gone, save a faint skein of smoke against the evening sky. And now my lost trunk came back into my thoughts, and Medicine Bow seemed a lonely spot. A sort of ship had left me marooned in a foreign ocean. The Pullman was comfortably steaming home to port, while I... And how was I to find Judge Henry's ranch? Where in this unfeatured wilderness was Sunk Creek? No creek or any water at all flowed here that I could perceive. My host had written he should meet me at the station and drive me to his ranch. This was all that I knew. He was not here. The baggage man had not seen him lately. The ranch was almost certain to be too far to walk to tonight. My trunk. I discovered myself still staring dolefully after the vanished eastbound. And at the same instant I became aware that the tall man was looking gravely at me, as gravely as he had looked at Uncle Huey throughout their remarkable conversation. To see his eye thus fixing me, and his thumb still hooked in his cartridge belt. Certain tales of travelers from these parts forced themselves disquietingly into my recollection. Now that Uncle Huey was gone, was I to take his place and be, for instance, invited to dance on the platform to the music of shots nicely aimed?
"I reckon I'm looking for you, sir," the tall man now observed.
Join me next week on the Sagebrush Trail for more adventures out west with the Virginian by Owen Wister.